Ross Chapman hated the night shift. It gave him too much time to reflect on the mess he'd made of his life. At 16, he'd left school to work in one of his dad's electrical stores, secure in the knowledge that within a few years he'd be inheriting the old man's mantle, but things hadn't quite turned out as planned. The recession had hit Ross's lack of business acumen head-on, and his mini-empire, which it had taken his dad 3 decades to construct, had come crashing around his ears. Along with the business went the house in the country, the flash cars, and the expensive holidays. And now he, Meredith, and their daughter Jodie lived in a modest 3-bedroom house in Splott, next to the trading estate. And for the last few years, Ross had worked at the garage on Endell Road, often taking on spare shifts to make ends meet. Although he worked hard, he found it difficult to disagree with his teenage daughter's opinion, fostered by her grandfather, that he was one of life's losers. Catching sight of his reflection in the window overlooking the garage forecourt, Ross grimaced. Once he'd been fit and slim, even moderately good-looking. Now, nudging 40, he was podgy, tired, ground down by life. He looked away with a sigh and distracted himself by tidying the magazine racks. Now and again he glanced outside to see if there was anyone filling up at the pumps. Even for a drizzly Wednesday night in late September, however, it was quiet. At 10 p.m, less than 20 minutes away, he would seal himself in for the rest of his shift with a book or a newspaper, breaking off only to serve the occasional customer through the security grill. The next time Ross looked through the front window, someone was looking back at him. It was a scrawny guy in a bulky black jacket, a scarf concealing the lower half of his face. Alarm bells jangled in Ross's head even before he glanced beyond the figure and saw there was no car at the pumps. As the guy entered, Ross retreated behind the dubious safety of the counter. "Hi," he said, noticing when the guy was a few meters away that his right hand was stuffed deep into the pocket of his jacket. At that moment, Ross knew from the man's coiled stance and staring eyes exactly what would happen next. Sure enough, when the hand rose from the pocket, Ross was not surprised to see that there was a gun in it. The gun was black, chunky, and Ross found it hard to tear his eyes from the circle of the muzzle where the bullet would come out, even when the scrawny guy said, "Open the till." Ross froze. For a moment, he couldn't remember how to open the till. He glanced at the gun again and saw that it was shaking in the man's grip. Concentrating as if his life depended on it, Ross stabbed at the buttons and the till pinged open. Scooping out the notes, Ross put them on the counter. They came to £65. "That it?" the man said disdainfully. "Apart from some change," said Ross. He pointed at a metal hatch on the wall behind him. "We're not allowed to keep much in the till. Every so often we put it in the safe."
"Open the safe then," said the man. He was shaking and sweating.
"I haven't got the key," said Ross.
"Open it!"
the man screamed. Ross raised his hands. "Look, there's no point..." he began. And that was when the man shot him. Ross flinched and closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, he was somewhere else. At first, he saw nothing but darkness and wondered whether he was dead. Then his eyes adjusted, and he realized he was standing in a small room with bulging walls, dimly lit by a soft light from above. He sensed movement and turned to see a cot-like bed against the wall, containing a cadaverous old man who was struggling to sit up. The man was finding it difficult because of the straitjacket clamping his arms to his body. But by bending and straightening his legs in a concertina motion, he eventually managed it. The old man fixed glittering eyes on Ross and opened a mouth full of yellow teeth.
"Do you know who it is?" he croaked.
Before Ross could reply, he was back behind the counter in the garage, the gunman staring at him in disbelief. "What just..." Ross said. As if shocked by his voice, the guy jerked up the gun and shot him again. There was no pain, no sense of movement, of time passing. But suddenly Ross was back in the dimly lit cell, and the old man, sitting up now, was leering at him, his eyes almost bulging from their sockets. "Please," the old man begged, drool spilling from his mouth.
"Help me. Make it stop."
Then Ross was behind the counter in the garage once more, and the gunman was gaping in terror.
"I shot you," the gunman whispered.
The gun slipped from his nerveless fingers and clattered to the floor. Then, shaking so badly he could barely stand up, he stumbled away, almost falling as he wrenched open the door and fled into the night. Ross stood in the sudden silence, feeling oddly calm, disembodied. Eventually he turned to the phone on the wall, and there he stopped dead. In the plaster behind him were 2 ragged bullet holes, at which he stared in wonder.
Impossible though it seemed, he knew that for the bullets to have embedded themselves there, they would have had to have passed right through his chest. Torchwood, Mr. Invincible by Mark Morris. Read by Tom Price. The only thing occupying Jack's mind was a desire for revenge. Greatcoat flying behind him, he swept in through the door of Cardiff Police Station like a hurricane. People stared as he marched across to the desk sergeant. "Get me Sergeant Andy Davison," he snapped. The desk sergeant arched an eyebrow.
"Oh, yes. And who might you be?"
"Captain Jack Harkness, Torchwood," Jack said. The woman's face changed. Weary cynicism was replaced by shock, confusion.
"Torchwood? I thought you lot were all..."
"You thought wrong," said Jack curtly. With an effort, the desk sergeant pulled herself together. She picked up the phone, and 3 minutes later, Andy Davison appeared, fresh-faced as ever, somehow incongruous in his sergeant's uniform.
"Well, well," he exclaimed. "Look what the cat dragged in."
Jack frowned. In light of the circumstances, Andy's flippancy surprised him. "You got somewhere private we can talk?" he asked curtly. Andy looked taken aback, then said, "Sure," and led Jack to an empty interview room. Closing the door, he said, "So, Jack, why so serious? What's going on?" Jack's frown deepened.
"Am I missing something?"
Bewildered, Andy said, "You tell me."
"Oh, my God," Jack said in sudden realization. "You don't know."
"Know what?"
"About Gwen."
"What about Gwen?" said Andy. Then his eyes widened. "Has something happened to her?"
"I thought you'd know," said Jack. "I thought you'd be able to fill in the details for me. Unless..."
"Unless?" Suddenly hopeful, Jack said,
"Can you get me a phone?"
2 minutes later, he was ringing Gwen's mother's number in Swansea. The phone rang 4 times and then was picked up.
"Hello?" said a man's voice.
"Reese," said Jack.
"Jack," Reese exclaimed. "Talk about a bad penny. When did you turn up?" Before Jack could answer, he went on, "Don't tell me you're wanting Gwen for another one of your daft missions, because if you are..."
"It's nothing like that," said Jack quickly. And then, trying to sound casual, he asked, "So, Gwen's there with you, is she?"
"She's upstairs, bathing Anwyn. Do you want me to give her a shout?"
"No, it's probably best if she doesn't know I'm here."
Puzzled, Reese said,
"You okay, Jack? What's going on?"
"I'm okay," said Jack, and he took a deep breath. "Listen, Reese, is everything all right? Gwen's not involved in anything dangerous?"
"Not unless you count arguing with her mam over childcare." "Look, Jack, what is this? Is there something I should be worried about?"
"Hope not," said Jack. "Just keep Gwen safe and don't let her know that we've spoken. If there is anything, I'll work it out." He put the phone down before Reese could reply, then turned to an anxious-looking Andy.
"Are you going to tell me what this is all about, Jack?"
Andy said. Jack sighed. "I saw Gwen die," he began. 10 minutes later, Jack had filled Andy in on his reasons for returning to Cardiff. He told him how, on Cotopaluni's world, he had been assailed by a series of psychic attacks, during the last of which he had seen Gwen murdered by an unidentified gunman.
"Sort of hallucination, was it?" said Andy.
Jack shook his head. "It was more than that. I assumed it was a projection of actual events, but I guess I was wrong. It must have been a premonition."
"You mean it hasn't happened yet?"
Andy looked dubious.
"Wouldn't be a premonition if it had," replied Jack.
"But that's stupid. How can you see something that hasn't happened?"
"Because time isn't linear," said Jack. "Come on, Andy, you've been around Torchwood long enough to realise there are some things you just have to accept." Andy sighed.
"Why, whenever you show up, do I feel as if I've had the rug pulled from under my feet?"
"That'll be my natural charm and charisma," Jack said, grinning. Wearily, Andy said,
"All right, let's say you did have a premonition. What exactly did you see?"
"Not much," admitted Jack. "Gwen shot, Gwen falling, Gwen dead.
And that's it?"
"Afraid so."
"Well, what about the surroundings?"
Andy asked.
"Vague," said Jack.
"Any other clues? Was she with anyone? Did you see anything which might give us an idea when this thing's going to happen?"
Jack shook his head.
"What about the gunman?" Andy asked.
"Nothing. It was just Gwen. She had her hands out, palms facing the floor, like she was trying to calm things down. Then, bang, bang, 2 bullets in the chest. She fell. That was it."
"And you're sure she was dead?" said Andy.
Jack nodded emphatically. "Oh, yeah." Andy raised his eyebrows.
"It's not much to go on."
Anger flashed briefly across Jack's face. Hey, it's not like I could choose what to see, he sighed. I guess all we can do is keep Gwen out of trouble. Keep her away from you, you mean? Jack narrowed his eyes, and at first Andy thought he'd overstepped the mark. Then Jack said thoughtfully, That's the most sensible thing you've said.
Oh, thanks, said Andy, unsure whether he'd been insulted.
Could be that what I saw was a self-fulfilling prophecy, Jack mused. I see Gwen die, I come back to Cardiff, she finds out I'm here, we end up getting involved in something, she dies because of it.
On the other hand, it could be she gets shot because you're not here, said Andy.
You leave, Gwen gets involved in something, you're not here to back her up, she dies.
He spread his hands as though it was a fait accompli.
For the first time, I'm beginning to see how you got promoted, Jack said, smiling. However this thing works, I guess our job is to figure out what she might have got involved in and then deal with it ourselves.
He clapped his hands as though relishing the challenge. So, what you got for me?
Well, said Andy, there's this Mr. Invincible case. That's right up your street.
Mr. Invincible? Said Jack dubiously.
Andy nodded. I'll show you.
This is a joke, right? Jack said 15 minutes later.
He was looking at a compilation of CCTV clips, each of which depicted a podgy, middle-aged man who appeared to be not only indestructible, but in possession of comic book superhero powers. In the first clip, standing behind a counter in an all-night garage, he was shot at point-blank range, but remained standing, the bullets having apparently passed through his body. In subsequent clips, he was set on fire, shot again, stabbed, and even run down by a car, but on each occasion emerged unscathed. In the penultimate clip, wearing what appeared to be a blue and white superhero costume complete with cape, he scaled the side of a tall building like a spider. In the final clip, he ran so fast that he managed to catch up with a speeding car, whereupon he gave it a shove, which caused it to crash into a wall.
I wish it was a joke, Andy replied glumly.
So who is this guy? Jack asked. Andy handed him a file. His name's Ross Chapman. He's 39 years old, lived in Cardiff all his life. That first clip took place a few weeks ago at the garage where he worked. As you can see, Mr. Chapman was shot at point-blank range and not only survived, but appeared to have somehow dodged the bullets, despite the fact that they hit the wall directly behind him. That incident turned him into a local celebrity. Miracle Man cheats death, that sort of thing. Since then, our Mr. Chapman has become a one-man crime-fighting unit. He single-handedly brought down several crime syndicates in the city and has successfully intervened to prevent potential muggings, assaults, rapes, possibly even murders. Andy shook his head. It's weird, though. On each occasion, it's been almost as if...
His voice trailed off.
As if he knew beforehand what was going to happen? Jack finished for him. As if he'd been having... premonitions?
Andy looked startled. Is there a connection, do you think?
Only one way to find out, said Jack. Think I'll pay Ross Chapman a visit.
With a splintering crack, the lock gave way and the kitchen window swung open. Tez Bradley grinned. Told you it'd be easy. Come on. He climbed into the house, kicking aside the plants lined up along the sill. He took great pleasure in watching the china pots smash to pieces on the stone floor, spilling water and soil everywhere. He didn't care about the noise he was making. He knew the house was empty. He, Di, and Steve-O had seen the old biddy who owned it amble off to the shops with her stupid wheeled basket. Everyone knew her husband had snuffed it years ago and that she lived alone. There was no burglar alarm, and the window frames were old and rotten. Silly cow deserved to be robbed. Inside, Tez said,
Hey, you two go upstairs and I'll have a look down here. Grab anything decent.
Like what? Asked Steve-O.
I don't know. Jewellery and that? Old biddies always have loads of jewellery, don't they?
Di and Steve-O wandered off like obedient dogs. Tez rooted through the kitchen cupboards to see if there was anything worth nicking. He pocketed some loose change he found in a drawer and a couple of ornaments he thought his mum might like. Finding a plastic bottle of tomato ketchup, he squirted it around the kitchen, up the walls and over the furniture. Then, laughing, he wandered off to explore the rest of the ground floor rooms. There weren't many. A little snug at the back of the house, a toilet the size of a sentry box, and a larger room at the front. There wasn't much to nick, though. No PlayStation, no Xbox, no iPod, no computer equipment, no mobile phone. Even the TV was ancient and looked as if it weighed a ton. Tez pocketed a few more ornaments and then looked around with a scowl. He was wondering if he should trash the place to punish the old cow for not having better stuff to steal, when he started to feel odd.
At first he thought it was the air. It dragged at him like a warm, powerful breeze, and as it moved across his body, he felt as if it were taking his energy with it, filling his limbs with a glassy ache. He wondered if he was coming down with something, or if he'd got food poisoning from the dodgy burger at lunchtime. Taking a deep breath that made his chest hurt, he moved towards the door, bent almost double as if struggling against a strong wind. He felt a little better once he was standing in the hallway. The dragging sensation had lessened, at least, but he still felt weak, his limbs stiff, slow to respond. He moved to the bottom of the stairs, reaching out to steady himself against the newel post. His hand looked different, somehow gnarled, but it was only when he squinted, trying to bring it into focus, that he realized there was something wrong with his eyes. His vision was blurred, cloudy. What was wrong with him? Supporting himself against the newel post again, he shouted, "Lads!" His own voice shocked him. It was cracked and weak and thick, all at the same time. He cleared his throat and tried again. "Lads!" His second effort wasn't much better. Aware of movement above him, he looked up. Shadows shifted at the top of the stairs. "Steve-o," he said. "Die?" He heard a squawk of alarm and then a panicked exclamation.
"He knows our names!"
"Stop mucking about!" Tez shouted angrily, but his anger only made his voice sound worse, harsh and scratchy like chalk on a blackboard. There was further movement above him, more shifting shadows, then Steve-O's voice again, aggressive but nervous.
"Who are you?"
"What do you mean, who am I?" snapped Tez. "Stop acting like a dick!" "How do you know who we are?" said Di, trying to act tough. Tez would have run up the stairs and punched the both of them if he had had the energy. Instead, he barked, "I'm sick of this! We're leaving now, come on!" He was used to being obeyed without question, and so was surprised when his friends didn't comply.
"I said, come on!"
he repeated. In a strangely hollow voice, Steve-O asked, "Why are you wearing Tez's clothes?" Tez felt like he was in a bad dream. Suddenly furious, he shouted,
"Get down here, now!"
"Not till you tell us what you've done to Tez," said Steve-O.
"What are you talking about?" Tez screamed. "I am Tez!"
"No, you're not," said Steve-O.
"Who do you think I am, then?"
There was a moment's silence, and then Di said shakily,
"Oh, my God. You think it is Tez?"
Exasperated, Tez said,
"Of course it's me!"
In a small voice, Di said,
"What's happened to you?"
Tez shook his head.
"Nothing's happened to me."
"It has," said Steve-O.
"You've changed." "It's true," said Di. "Look in the mirror behind you."
Tez glared at the blurry shadows above him and then turned. Sure enough, there was a mirror on the wall. He saw the reflection of his face, a pinkish blur topped with... No, that couldn't be right. His hair was brown, not grey. Almost fearfully, he moved closer, his features coming into focus. He gasped, staring at the wrinkles, the liver spots, the saggy skin, the sparse grey hair.
"No way," he muttered. "No way."
What he was looking at was impossible, and yet somehow true. In the space of 5 minutes, Tez Bradley had aged from a 16-year-old boy into an 80-year-old man. The police car halted in a street of unassuming, identical houses, and Jack got out. Even if he hadn't known, it would have been obvious which of the houses belonged to Ross Chapman. Encamped on the front lawn was a group of what could only be described as acolytes. Some were dressed in homemade versions of the blue and white costume Ross had been wearing on the CCTV footage. Others wore T-shirts emblazoned with the logo Cardiff's Own and a grainy head-and-shoulders shot of Ross's plump face. The acolytes sat around in politely chatting groups, drinking tea and eating sandwiches, and occasionally casting adoring glances at the modest house with its blue front door and net-curtained windows. Jack wondered what these people did at night or when it rained. He wondered, too, about the mentality of those who so badly needed someone to idolise. Outside the front gate, Jack ran a gauntlet of reporters who were milling on the pavement. With practiced ease, he ignored the questions fired at him, adopting an air of superiority and confidence. He strolled up the garden path towards a pair of armed police officers in riot gear. Andy had told him that Chapman enjoyed an uneasy alliance with the police, their slight antipathy towards him due not to the fact that he had made them look bad, but because the authorities couldn't be seen to condone vigilante justice. Even though the armed officers had seen Jack emerge from the police car, they still demanded he show them some ID. Spreading his hands, Jack said, "Torchwood, we don't carry ID," and grinned as one of them rolled his eyes. Grudgingly, the officers stepped aside as Jack rang the doorbell. After a few moments, the door inched open and a woman peered at him. Jack flashed his most charming smile.
"Hi," he said. "Mrs. Chapman?"
"Yes," said the woman, her manner defensive.
"My name is Captain Jack Harkness, Mrs. Chapman. I really think we should talk."
"What about?"
Jack leaned forward.
"To be honest, Mrs. Chapman, I'm concerned for your family. I deal with the unusual, the unexplained, and I know what a strain it can be to encounter something beyond your normal experience and understanding. I'm guessing you're a little disorientated right now. I want to help if I can."
As Jack had expected, Meredith Chapman's shoulders slumped in relief and a look of gratitude, even hope, crossed her face.
"Well, I don't know how,"
she said uncertainly. Jack's charm offensive went into overdrive.
"Are you willing to let me try?"
Another split second's hesitation, and then Meredith Chapman said,
"Come in."
Once Jack was inside, she led him along the hallway and into a neat and tidy sitting room. It was all comfortingly normal, the evidence indicating a family life quietly and conventionally lived. Above the fireplace was a family photograph, evidently taken in a studio. The Chapmans were in their Sunday best, smiles fixed to their faces. The girl, between her parents, looked about 8, a scrawny, gawky thing, clearly self-conscious despite her smile.
"That's a beautiful photograph," said Jack. "Was it taken recently?"
Meredith gave a snort of amusement, but there was sadness in the humour.
"No, we couldn't afford anything like that now," she said,
and then, as if realising she'd given too much away,
"it's from about 6 years ago. Our Jodie's 14 now. She's reached the age where she finds that picture embarrassing, but I still like it. Coffee?"
"That'd be great," said Jack. 5 minutes later, coffee in hand, he asked,
"So tell me, Mrs. Chapman."
"Meredith,"
she interrupted, almost shyly.
"Even better. So tell me, Meredith, how has your husband's newfound status affected you and Jodie?"
For a few seconds she stared into her coffee as though the answer might be swirling in its depths. Then she said,
"To tell you the truth, Captain Harkness..."
"Jack," he said gently.
"To tell you the truth, Jack, it's set us all on edge. Ross has changed. He's always been a quiet man. Kind. A bit too kind sometimes. But there's nothing wrong with that, is there?"
Jack shook his head, his silence encouraging her to continue.
"But just lately," she went on, "he's become not just preoccupied, but harder, more arrogant. He's starting to..."
"Believe his own hype?" suggested Jack.
"Yes," she said, "that's it. He's acting a bit too high and mighty. But underneath it all..."
She shook her head.
"I think he's scared. None of us know where this came from, or where it'll end up, Ross included."
"How did it start?" Jack asked. Meredith looked uncomfortable, and Jack knew he would have to tread warily if he didn't want her to clam up.
"It just did. After that night when the man tried to shoot him. You've seen it on TV, I suppose. God knows they've shown it often enough."
Jack nodded.
"That was the start of it. Since then, his powers have grown."
She hesitated. Jack prompted her gently.
"You can say whatever you like to me, and I promise you, Meredith, I'll believe you. You don't have to be afraid."
She gazed into his eyes, desperate to trust him. Then softly she said,
"Do you think it's possible that these powers, wherever they've come from, could be contagious?"
"Contagious?" Jack raised his eyebrows. Meredith blushed.
"Maybe that's the wrong word. It's just..."
"Go on."
"Well, a couple of nights ago I had a nightmare. When I woke up I was upside down on the ceiling, clinging there like a fly. Then yesterday I opened a kitchen cupboard and ripped the door off its hinges."
Her face threatened to crumple, but she managed to compose herself.
"I'm scared, Jack. What does it mean? What's happening to us?"
"I don't know," admitted Jack. "But I'm going to find out." The words had barely left his mouth when the door flew open. He turned to see Ross Chapman glaring at him. Despite his recently acquired attributes, Cardiff's newest hero was as podgy and bland-looking as he had been in the photographs and CCTV footage. He was dressed in his now familiar blue-and-white superhero costume, made of some shiny spandex-like material. Jack couldn't help thinking it did Ross no favours whatsoever, serving only to emphasise his pot belly and bulging hips. Despite the man's abilities, Jack couldn't help feeling a little embarrassed for Ross Chapman. Before he could say anything, Ross barked, "Who's this?"
"Captain Jack Harkness," Jack said smoothly, before Meredith could reply.
He offered his hand, which Ross ignored.
"Jack's here to help," Meredith said nervously.
"We don't need his help," Ross replied. Ignoring his hostility, Jack grinned. "Cool costume." Nodding at the logo on Ross's chest, he said,
"MRI. What's that, your sponsor?"
Ross rolled his eyes contemptuously. Meredith said,
"It's what he calls himself, Mr. I. It stands for Mr. Invincible, but it also has a double meaning."
"Oh, I get it," said Jack. "Mr. I. Mystery, right. Very clever. Except, well, strictly speaking, shouldn't it be Mr. E? Though then I guess you'd have to change your name to, Mr. Excellent? Mr. Exceptional?"
Jack looked at Ross, who was now glaring at him even more intently, mouth set in a terse line.
Meredith, on her husband's right, was staring at Jack in teeth-clenched horror, shaking her head warningly from side to side. Seeing her, Jack said smoothly,
"Okay, moving right along. The thing is, Ross, whatever you call yourself, your identity isn't a secret, is it? Everyone knows who you are. Have you ever thought how dangerous that might be? For your family, I mean."
Ross narrowed his eyes. "Are you threatening me?"
"No way," said Jack. "Like Meredith says, I'm here to help.
And like I said, we don't need your help."
"Oh, I think you do," said Jack. "Because take it from one who knows, Ross, there's no such thing as a free lunch."
"What's that supposed to mean?" Ross growled.
"It means no one ever gets something for nothing. It means that everything has consequences."
Ross wafted a hand dismissively. To his wife, he said,
"Get rid of him, Meredith. He's just another freeloader." "Where are you going?" Meredith asked as he turned towards the door.
"I have an assignment." He glanced at Jack pointedly. "Lives to save."
"I'm interested," Jack said. "Where do these assignments come from? How do you know where to go?"
But Ross ignored him. He exited the room, slamming the door. Jack drained his coffee and stood up, half thinking he should follow Ross, but wondering how he was going to do it. "I'd better go." Meredith hesitated, then reached into her pocket and withdrew a folded sheet of paper.
"I found this in the bin," she murmured. "Ross doesn't know I've got it."
Jack took the paper curiously. The sheet was the size of his palm and ragged at the top, as if it had been torn from a small notepad. Written on it in pencil was a date, a time, and a street name. The date was 5 days earlier.
"It's one of his assignments," she said. "I think he gets them a day or two in advance."
"Where from?" Jack asked.
"I don't know. But that's Ross's writing, so maybe someone calls him, or..."
"Or?" prompted Jack.
"I was going to say, or maybe they just come into his head. But that would be silly, wouldn't it?"
Jack said nothing. He looked at the paper again. At the top, on one side of the ragged edge, he could make out a couple of printed numbers, 4 and 8. The end of a phone number, perhaps. "Mind if I keep this?" he asked. Meredith shrugged.
"No, if you think it might be useful."
Jack slipped it into his pocket. Suddenly he was eager to be off, to follow Ross, or, failing that, get the sheet of paper analysed. Walking to the door, he said, "You need me? You call me. You got a cell phone?" Meredith nodded. "Let me give you my number." Jack had bullied Andy into procuring a phone for him. He rattled off the number to Meredith as he strode into the hallway. At the front door, he turned back, just in time to glimpse a girl ducking out of sight at the top of the stairs. Although he hadn't seen her properly, he was left with an image of lank hair framing a face blotchy with acne and the flash of metal braces on slightly protruding teeth. "Hi," he called, but received no reply. Looking at Meredith, he asked quietly, "How's Jodie coping with all this?" Meredith grimaced.
"Jodie's always been a quiet girl, but just lately she's become even more moody and withdrawn." She tried to smile. "You know how teenagers are."
Jack didn't. Not really. It had been a long time since he'd been one. All the same, he nodded. Taking Meredith's hand briefly, he said,
"You hang on in there, Meredith. Everything will work out just fine." Then he left.
Sergeant Andy Davison had witnessed some odd things in his time, even before the miracle, where for several months the entire world had been turned upside down. He'd personally dealt with a real Roman centurion, seen zombies stalking the streets of Cardiff, and confronted a shape-shifting alien in the British Museum. A last encounter had happened just a few weeks ago, but no matter how many times he found himself in the presence of the supernatural and the downright weird, he could still never really get used to it.
Maybe that was why Gwen had refused his request to join Torchwood all those years ago. Because he wasn't like her and the rest of them. He couldn't just take it all in his stride.
The later situation was a case in point. At 3 p.m. that afternoon, he'd received a call from a Mrs. Margaret Jones, wife of the vicar of the Church of St. Emmanuel on Godalpha Street. Mrs. Jones seemed to be under the impression that her husband, Robert, had been either the victim or the beneficiary of some kind of divine intervention. He'd gone over to the church that morning to rehearse his sermon for the following Sunday and had not returned home for lunch. This was not unusual in itself. The Reverend often became engrossed in his work, and time sometimes ran away with him. However, when Margaret texted her husband at 2:30 p.m. to check that he was all right and received no response, she decided to pop across. What she had found on the stone floor beside the pulpit, wrapped in her absent husband's crumpled clothes, was a naked baby boy, fast asleep. Although an astonishing discovery, Margaret had first tried to rationalize it. It was not unknown for young girls to fall pregnant in the parish and seek her husband's advice. Could it be that one of these girls had given birth in secret and left her newborn baby here, hoping that a good home could be found for it? Almost immediately, however, Margaret had realized how porous her theory was. For one thing, the baby wasn't newborn. It was a healthy and rosy 6 or 7 months old. And where was Robert? Even if he had gone to call the authorities, he wouldn't have left the baby on the stone floor. And another oddity was the fact that the baby was swathed in a pile of her husband's clothes. Not just his jumper, but all his clothes, including his shoes, socks, and underwear. It was when she picked the baby up, however, that she got the biggest shock of all.
"It was there on his hip," she told Andy.
"What was?" he asked.
"His birthmark," she said, "in the shape of a star. He called it his personal Star of Bethlehem."
"I'm sorry," said Andy, confused. "Who are we talking about?"
"Robert," said Margaret Jones patiently. "Don't you see, Sergeant? The baby is my husband. He's been transformed. Time has been reversed, and he's been given his life anew."
Andy might have considered the vicar's wife a few parishioners short of a congregation if it hadn't been for the other calls that filtered through over the next few hours. In Tremorpha, a group of terrified schoolchildren had seen a teacher revert to boyhood before their eyes. In Grangetown, workmen on a building site had watched in horror as two of their colleagues had aged, died, and decomposed to skeletons in a matter of minutes. The same thing had happened to a woman in a tea shop on Havelock Street. And when the manager had stepped forward to cover her rotting body from the horrified gaze of other customers, his hand, according to one witness, had shriveled like old leaves. By the time Andy got the chance to call Jack, he was in a cab, heading off on a mission of his own. "Do you think this has got anything to do with your premonition?" Andy asked.
"If it has, I don't see how," replied Jack, "apart from the fact that there seems to be some time distortion involved."
"When you back?" Andy wanted to know, trying not to sound as desperate as he felt.
"Tonight, I guess. You want me to call at the station? When do you get off duty?"
"Oh, the way things are going, who knows," said Andy with a sigh. The Delmore Institute, a psychiatric rehabilitation centre on the outskirts of Dynas Powys, had once been the country estate of landed gentry. Built in the 1760s, it was a hugely impressive building. Jack paid off the taxi driver and ascended a flight of wide stone steps to the front entrance. If you had to go mad, there were worse places to do it, he reflected as he rang the doorbell. 5 minutes later, he was reclining in a leather armchair, facing the Institute's superintendent across her highly polished desk. Dr. Jacqueline Reynolds was a handsome, immaculately coiffured woman in her 50s, whose brisk but not unfriendly demeanour gave the impression of precision and efficiency. Jack had no reason to suspect her of anything underhand, but beneath his deceptively easy manner, he was on his guard, just in case. "Yes," Dr. Reynolds said, examining the notepaper which Jack had produced. "This is from one of our notepads." Jack indicated the photograph of Ross Chapman, which he had also placed before Dr. Reynolds. "But you say this man has never been here?"
"Not to my knowledge," she replied smoothly. "I recognise him from the television, of course, but I've never seen him on the premises. However, I don't oversee the arrival of every visitor. You are, of course, free to examine any records you feel may aid your investigation, Captain Harkness."
"Thanks," said Jack. "You're very accommodating." He was shown into an empty office and provided with the passwords that would allow him access to the Institute's computer system. Finding nothing in the visitor log, he turned his attention to the patient records, searching for something that might suggest that an inmate at the Institute had had contact with Ross Chapman. It took him almost an hour, but at last he found it. A 77-year-old patient called Henry Bavistock, a retired railway worker, had been admitted to the Institute a month ago, suffering from chronic paranoid delusions. Bavistock had complained initially of suffering from bad dreams and then of having a demon inside his head, which frequently whispered to him, relaying its instructions. When asked what these instructions were, Bavistock had replied, "They don't make sense. They're just dates and times and places." Since being admitted to the Institute, he had claimed that a man sometimes visited his room at night, a man who kept appearing and disappearing, and to whom Bavistock had been ordered to relay the demon's words. Jack returned to the superintendent's office, waving a printout of the old man's records. "I need to see this guy," he said. Dr. Reynolds took the printout from him.
"Mr. Bavistock? Why?"
"Ross Chapman is getting information about crimes before they happen. That's why he's always in the right place at the right time." He took a deep breath. "I think this man is giving him that information." Dr. Reynolds regarded him coolly.
"You realize what you're saying?"
"Oh, yeah," said Jack, "and I know how crazy it sounds, but is it any crazier than a man who can run 80 miles an hour and is impervious to bullets?" 5 minutes later, Jack and a male nurse called Anton, a jovial, overweight black man who seemed to roll rather than walk, were standing outside a grey door on the third floor. Beside the door was a wooden chair with its back to the wall. Pointing at it, Anton said, "Take the chair in with you to sit on, but bring it out again after. Mr. Bavistock's not violent, but he gets so agitated sometimes that we have to restrain him, so he won't hurt himself. I'll be right here in case you need anything, okay?" Jack nodded. Rapping gently on the door, Anton said, "Mr. Bavistock?"
"Yes?"
replied a weak voice from within. "You decent in there? You have a visitor?" After a short silence, the voice cautiously asked,
"Who?"
"See for yourself," Anton said, unlocking the door. Jack picked up the chair and entered the room. Henry Bavistock was sitting on his bed, a well-thumbed Alistair MacLean paperback clutched in his bony hands. He was thin and scrawny and looked exhausted, as if he hadn't slept in weeks. "Hi," Jack said, setting the chair down and sitting on it.
"Who are you?"
asked Bavistock, his eyes twitching.
"A friend," replied Jack. "I'm here to help."
"How?" "First by identifying whatever's inside your head." Bavistock gave Jack a sly look, then nodded towards the door.
"They say there's nothing except my own thoughts. They think I'm doing this to myself."
"But we know that's not true, don't we?"
"Do we?"
Bavistock said. "I'm not trying to humour you, Mr. Bavistock," said Jack. "I'm not here to win your trust by pretending to believe what the doctors assume are paranoid delusions. See, I know you're the victim of some kind of psychic subjugation. What I want to know is why, and by what." Bavistock looked at him with mistrust, but also with a desperate kind of hope.
"How do I know I can believe you?"
"You say a man visits your room sometimes. A man to whom you have to pass on the information the demon gives you?" Bavistock nodded. "You believe that man is real?" Jack asked.
"I think so. Yes,
whispered Bavistock. "So if I were to show you a photograph of that man," Jack said, "would you believe me then?" Bavistock looked startled.
"Do you have a photograph?"
"I think so. My concern is how you might respond to it. Anton out there says you get pretty agitated sometimes." Bavistock rolled his eyes.
"Only when the thing is inside me."
He touched his temple.
"It hurts, Captain Harkness, and it's frightening. When it comes, I feel like a mouse tormented by a cat. It's so powerful."
His words had dropped to a whisper. Jack leaned forward and placed a reassuring hand on Bavistock's bony shoulder. "This guy who visits you is as much a victim as you are, only he doesn't know it yet."
"Who is he?"
asked Bavistock. Jack reached into his coat pocket and produced Ross Chapman's picture. He handed it over, watching Bavistock's reaction carefully. The old man hissed in a breath and his eyes widened. "His name is Ross Chapman," said Jack. "Like you, he's had a pretty crazy few weeks." He gave the old man a potted account of Chapman's recent apotheosis from failed businessman to Cardiff's very own crime-busting superhero. "Now," he said softly, "K,
Care to tell me your story?
Bavistock sighed.
There's not much to tell. I was in the garden one day doing a spot of weeding, and suddenly this thing pounced on me.
Pounced? Said Jack.
That's what it felt like. I felt its words in my head, not a voice exactly, but as if it was burning each letter into my brain.
His face creased at the memory.
It was agonizing.
What did it say?
It said it had a job for me. It told me not to be scared, that it wouldn't hurt me. But it did hurt me, Captain Harkness. It hurt so much.
It was clear the old man was terrified of the entity returning, of the terrible agony tearing through his mind once more. Tightening his grip on Bavistock's shoulder, Jack said, "Don't worry, Mr. Bavistock. I'm going to find out what this thing is, and I'm going to make it stop. You have my word."
"Time whirlpools?" said Jack.
Andy looked embarrassed.
"That's what everyone's calling them. No one has any idea what they really are."
"And you say they're getting bigger?" Andy nodded.
"Because of their effects, we're treating them as contaminated areas, throwing up exclusion barriers around them. But in some places, the barriers have corroded. In others, they've simply vanished. We've had a few accidents among police personnel, not to mention the civilian casualties already reported. One of my officers is now a 3-year-old toddler, and another is... well, there are two of him, one about 10 years older than the other."
"Inconvenient," said Jack. "Or it could be handy, Andy."
"It's not funny, Jack," snapped Andy. "These things are spreading, and there are reports of more of them coming in all the time. What if they spread over the whole of Cardiff and keep on spreading?"
For a few moments, Jack didn't reply. He peered thoughtfully at the large map of Cardiff dominating one wall of Andy's office. It was peppered with red dots, each of which indicated the location of what Andy had termed a time whirlpool. There were at least 50 of them, and their formulation over the past 9 hours had so far resulted in the deaths of 17 people. On top of that, another 20 or so were missing, apparently plucked out of existence, and at least another 30 had fallen victim to the whirlpool's peculiar temporal effects.
"You got a long ruler and a pen?" Jack asked eventually.
"What for?" Andy said.
"I want to try something."
Andy shrugged and went off to find what Jack wanted, returning a few minutes later. Jack took the pen and ruler from him and started drawing lines across the map, linking up the whirlpool sites at their furthest points east and west and north and south of the city. When he'd finished, the web of lines resembled a starburst radiating outwards from a central point. Jack prodded the central point with his finger. "You know where that is?" Andy stared. So many lines had crossed over that the name of the road had been blacked out. But suddenly he realized.
"Oh my God."
Jack nodded grimly. 24 Endell Drive, Splott. The home of Ross Chapman. As the car which had brought him slewed round and drove away, Jack turned his attention to Endell Drive. It stretched before him, the eye of the storm, where past, present and future converged as one. It was bewildering to witness, the skies constantly changing, moving from day to night, from sunshine to rain, in a rapid, kaleidoscopic procession. The houses flickered with change too, the colours of the doors, the shapes of the windows, the front gates, the gardens, the cars and the drives. But it was the people caught in the maelstrom which made the scene truly nightmarish. They were trapped in an endless cycle of time. Acolytes, journalists and police officers alike shimmering between birth and death and all points in between in the blink of an eye. What agonies they must be going through, Jack could only imagine. He hoped they weren't aware of what was happening to them, though the shock and fear and pain on their faces suggested otherwise. Taking a deep breath, he began to walk through the ever-shifting landscape. He felt time swarming around him, latching onto him, trying to draw him in, bend him to its will. It was an uncomfortable and debilitating experience, like being tugged and buffeted by vast, invisible forces. And yet, even as time tried to exert its influence, Jack sensed it rejecting him, veering away, flinching like a child afraid of burning its fingers. He was something different, something other, something it couldn't control or understand. He tried not to look at the crowd gathered around number 24 as he weaved between them. Even so, he couldn't help but glimpse the occasional tortured, shifting face, couldn't help but be aware of whole lives lived in seconds, over and over again,
an ever-repeating loop of plump toddler bodies elongating into adulthood before shrinking into old age and infirmity. He struggled up the path through darkness and light, days and seasons and years flying rapidly by. The lawn grew long, then short, parched, then saturated. The house was like a living thing, its walls seeming to twitch and ripple as time continually eroded, then restored its outer skin. By the time he reached the front door, Jack felt battered and exhausted. He reached for the handle, now tarnished, now gleaming, and twisted it. The door opened, and he all but fell into the house. With an effort, he kicked the door closed behind him and became instantly aware of the stillness in the air. Slowly he straightened up, already knowing that here, inside the house, was the real eye of the storm. He was about to call out when he heard a noise from upstairs, a thump, a cry of distress. Immediately he raced up the stairs. "Meredith!" he shouted.
"In here!"
Her voice was shrill with panic. It was coming from behind a door bearing a yellow and black sticker which read, "Hazardous chemicals, keep out." Jack burst into the room. Meredith was cowering by a dressing table to his left, an arm shielding her eyes. Over by the far wall, hovering a meter above a bed with a spotty red and white duvet, was Jodie. The girl had her head thrown back, her arms outstretched. Threads of piercing light snaked from her body and swirled around her. Ignoring Meredith's warning, Jack approached her, reaching out with both hands. Jodie's head snapped down. Her eyes were blazing, but she looked distressed, scared.
"Don't touch me!"
"It's okay," Jack said, moving closer still. He clenched his teeth as raw time washed over his skin, tingling, stinging, probing. And then, as before, flinching back, withdrawing from him. "It's okay," he said again, more gently, and he took Jodie's hands. He gasped as the link was made, as, for a moment, he seemed to step outside of reality, to share her ability not only to compress time into a single instant, but to select individual moments and exist in them, influence them. "It was you, wasn't it?" he said, unsure whether he was speaking the words or merely thinking them. "You gave your dad those powers. You created the whirlpools. It was all you." "Yes," said Jodie. "Who are you?" Jack asked. "What are you?" He sensed her fear, her confusion.
"I don't know."
"Why did you do it?" he asked. And immediately he sensed a fresh and complex swirl of emotions from her. The uncertainty and embarrassment of youth, the acute distress of not fitting in, the conflicting emotions of shame and resentment, and pride and love she felt towards her father.
"I wanted to be liked," she said. "I wanted Dad to be respected again, to be cool."
Then her thoughts dissolved into a tangle of fear and confusion. "But it's all going wrong. I don't know how to control it." "It's okay," Jack said. "We'll work it out. Stay with me, Jodie. Stay calm. Tell me about the old man."
"Who?"
"Henry Bavistock. You used him, tormented him." Again, he sensed her shame, her misery.
"No, no, not tormented."
"Yes," said Jack firmly. "He's in a psychiatric institute because of you. Why did you do it?" She was a little girl lost. Her voice in his mind was small, weak.
"I didn't mean to hurt him. He was special. He was..."
Jack sensed her searching for the right word.
"Receptive. I didn't want Dad to know it was me, so I used the old man as a..."
Again, she struggled to express herself. "Conduit?" suggested Jack.
"Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cause any trouble."
He knew she was telling the truth. He could feel thoughts and emotions pulsing off her in waves. She had wanted to be liked, but was too shy to cope with the attention of being thought a hero, and so had transferred her abilities to her father, hoping to bask in his glory. Jack wanted to help her, but was at a loss. He didn't know how to stop this, didn't know where these powers of hers had come from. Suddenly she gasped.
"I see it!"
"What?" Jack asked. "What do you see?"
"I see why you're here. I see her."
"Gwen?" whispered Jack.
"Gwen, yes," she said. "Come with me."
Jack had no sensation of moving, of travelling. Rather, it was as if he and Jodie remained where they were, whilst time and space revolved around them. One second they were in Jodie's bedroom, and the next they were...
where?
Jack looked around. It was an ordinary street in an ordinary town. There were people,
shops and cars, grey pavements to match the grey skies. But all was still and silent. Nothing was moving. It was like being inside a photograph. Time held in suspension. The universe had stopped. Then Jack looked again and realized that the universe hadn't quite stopped after all. He saw a shadow creeping across the ground, infinitesimally slowly. He saw a piece of paper suspended in the air, but turning millimeter by millimeter, like a film progressing one frame at a time. As his vision adjusted, he realized that there was, in fact, movement everywhere. Incremental shifts of pattern and light. Time was pushing ever onwards, but he and Jody were outside it, unaffected by it. She squeezed his hands. "There," she said. She didn't have to point or turn her head for Jack to know where she was looking. He let go of her hands and began to run, past a big issue seller and on towards the crowd gathered outside the jeweler's shop. As he ran, he took in details. Gwen and Reese. She in her familiar leather jacket and black jeans. He a few metres behind in a grey hooded top, a plastic shopping bag in his hand. Just as in his vision, Gwen had her hands up, palms down, as if she was trying to calm a volatile situation. But the deed had already been done. A pair of dark grey glints in the air between Gwen and the gunman, who was half twisted towards her, his weapon raised, told Jack that the trigger had been pulled. The bullets expended, bullets which were even now more than halfway to their target.
"Gwen!"
he shouted, knowing that she couldn't hear him, couldn't see him, that he was moving too fast to be perceived in real time. Faster than a speeding bullet, he thought, and hoped that was true. Because in a world where everything else was moving so slowly that it seemed damn near motionless, he could actually see the air rippling and splintering around those two dark bullets, those tiny individual chunks of death, as they bore down inexorably on their target. "I'm not going to make it," Jack thought. "I'm not going to make it." Breath tearing in his chest, he ducked around and between the statue-like members of the crowd. The bullets were less than a meter from Gwen now and closing all the time. Though they seemed to move slowly, Jack knew that when they reached her, they would push through her skin as easily as he could push his finger through butter, and they would keep pushing until they found her heart. 3/4 of a meter, 1/2 a meter, Jack threw himself forward. He was just in time to squeeze himself between Gwen and the bullets that would have ended her life. He felt them touch his chest and waited, head back, fists and teeth clenched, for them to slowly, slowly end his. Just because it was always the same didn't mean it was ever any easier. It was like an eruption inside him, like a shot of pure adrenaline straight into his heart. He sat up with a gasp, air rushing into his lungs violently enough to make his head spin. Close by, someone screamed. He blinked. He was back in Jody's room, sitting on the carpet. Meredith was staring at him, ashen-faced.
"I thought you were dead."
"Me? Never," said Jack with a smile. He took in the situation at a glance. Jody was lying on her bed, eyes closed, pale. The light was no longer swirling around her body.
"What happened?" "I don't know," said Meredith. "You both disappeared, just like that. And then suddenly there was this flash, and back you were."
Jack jumped to his feet, scrambled across to the bed. He checked Jody's pulse, listened to her heart. Both were fluttering, irregular. "We need to get her to a hospital," he said.
"Is she?"
Meredith began, but Jack cut her off. "I don't know," he snapped. "I don't know what I'm up against here." He gestured at the window where the sky was still rippling between dark and light, time running out of control.
"Jody's causing that," he said. "But how? She's only human. Where does she get her power from?"
"Not from her parents, unless there's something you and Ross aren't telling me." He saw Meredith's sudden expression of startled guilt. "What?" he demanded. Her face crumpled. In a small, tearful voice, she said,
"It's just that... well... Ross isn't Jody's father."
Tanya Munro had just finished a 12-hour shift at St. Helens Hospital and was crossing the staff car park when a rat-faced kid in a black baseball cap stepped out from between two cars. The kid had chunky rings on his fingers and around his neck hung a chain that looked as if it might once have been used to flush toilets. He also had a knife in his hand, which he was pointing at her face.
"Give me a bag, bitch," he snarled.
Ordinarily, Tanya might have obeyed, but today's shift had been so demanding, she hated the idea of handing over her hard-earned wages.
On this occasion, therefore, she found herself retorting,
"Get lost, you little creep."
The kid's face hardened. "Give me the bag, now, or you're dead."
"I don't think so," said a voice behind him.
The kid turned to confront the new arrival. Over his shoulder, Tanya saw a paunchy, middle-aged man in a shimmery blue and white superhero costume. She might have thought he was on his way to a fancy dress party if she hadn't seen him on the telly.
"You're Ross Chapman," she exclaimed.
Chapman flashed her a small, smug smile and then turned his attention back to the kid.
"You going to drop that knife or do you want me to take it from you?"
Clearly scared, the kid waved the knife in the air.
"Leave me alone."
Chapman sighed and then suddenly jumped forward, arm outstretched to grab the knife. The kid reacted instinctively, thrusting the knife forward. For a second, Chapman and the kid were clamped together in a clumsy embrace. Then the kid staggered back and Tanya screamed. The hilt of the knife was sticking out of Chapman's belly, and dark red blood was spilling out of the wound and across the front of his costume. Panic-stricken, the kid swung round to confront Tanya. Wild-eyed, he stammered,
I didn't mean to... He made me!"
Then he turned and ran, like a little kid chased by the school bully. Chapman stood staring down in disbelief at the knife handle protruding from his belly. His face was pale and sweaty, and his lips looked almost grey. In a slurred voice, he said,
"That's not supposed to..."
Then his eyes rolled up into his head, and his legs crumpled beneath him.
"Tell me," ordered Jack.
Meredith flapped a hand, flustered and upset.
"It was a long time ago. I didn't think it was important."
"Not important?" Jack tried to maintain his composure. "Jodie caused all this, and it's destroying her. How can you not think..."
"I didn't know it was Jodie,"
Meredith interrupted shrilly.
"Not until just now."
Jack put his hands on her shoulders. "Tell me," he repeated soothingly. Meredith took a shuddering breath.
"It was 15 years ago. He was gentle and kind and so beautiful. Tall, blonde." She gave a wistful laugh. "God knows what he saw in me. He used to joke that he was a fallen angel."
She paused.
"What's the matter? Why are you looking at me like that?"
Jack's eyes were wide. "It can't be," he breathed.
"What can't? What are you talking about?"
Suddenly excited, he asked, "What was his name?" Meredith frowned.
"It was a funny name. Foreign. Belphegor."
"My God," cried Jack, loudly enough to make Meredith jump.
"He was an Arquelian." "A what?"
"An Arquelian. They're an incredibly powerful race, can manipulate time and matter like it was play putty. Luckily they're a pretty benign bunch, and good looking.
Tell me about it."
Before she could comment, he said, "What happened to him?"
"He had to go away," Meredith replied. "Abroad, I think. I never saw him again."
"Did he give you anything?" asked Jack. "Apart from Jodie, of course. A parting gift, maybe?"
"Yes, a necklace. He said I was to give it to Jodie when she was old enough. He said I'd know when that was."
"Where is the necklace?"
"In my jewellery drawer."
"Fetch it, quick." Alarmed by his urgency, Meredith hurried out of the room and reappeared a minute later with a slim red box. Jack snatched it and tore off the lid. Inside was an oval, amber-coloured stone on a thin, silvery chain. Almost reverently, Jack lifted it from the box and approached the bed. Raising Jodie's head with one hand, he slipped the necklace around her neck. Nothing happened. Jack glanced anxiously out of the window. Time was still running out of control out there. Day into night, winter into summer. Then Jodie's eyes snapped open and she sat up, her mouth gaping as she gulped air. It reminded Jack of how life slammed back into his own body each time he died. A moment later, the amber stone started to glow. It shimmered gently at first, as though acclimatizing to its surroundings. And then suddenly it erupted into life, blazing so fiercely that Meredith cried out and stumbled into the wall as if physically shoved aside. With an effort, Jack stood his ground, shielding his eyes as the light saturated the room. He became aware once again of time flowing over his skin, prickling and probing before veering away, as if he and it were opposing forces. Although he couldn't see it, his earlier link with Jodie enabled him to visualize the flow of time as individual threads of a vast, knotted mass, which were slowly separating and untangling as they were drawn into the heart of the Arquelian stone. As the multiple time streams flowed apart, Jack again looked out of the window. He saw the world stabilizing, saw the effects of compacted time slowing, diminishing. No longer were the people out there racing through entire lifespans countless times a second. No longer was the sky flickering between dark and light in a bewildering blur. Slowly but surely, days, seasons, and years were rearranging themselves into their proper order as the stone around Jodie's neck siphoned off her wayward power. It took several minutes, but at last the sky adopted the murky hue of a typically drizzly day in Cardiff and stayed there. Likewise, the people below, released from the grip of fractured time, became fixed points once again. Jack saw them milling about, confused and frightened, like the survivors of an earthquake. It was Meredith's shocked gasp that caused him to turn his attention back to Jodie. The light which had blazed from the necklace was fading now, the teenager's uncontrollable power and the damage it had caused absorbed into the amber stone. But it wasn't only Jodie's power which had been absorbed. Judging by her appearance, the stone had also drawn out her imperfections and insecurities. Not only did Jodie now look better, eyes shining, skin glowing, but she seemed to have adopted a new poise and confidence. "You all right, love?" Meredith said tentatively. Jodie smiled serenely. "Yes," she said. "I'm fine." Jack was about to comment when the phone in his pocket rang. "What's the betting that'll be my friend Andy calling to tell me the time whirlpools have disappeared?" Grinning, he raised the phone to his ear. "Hey, Andy, before you say anything, yes, that was me. But go a little easy on the hero worship, okay? You'll only embarrass yourself." He listened to Andy's response and his face fell.
"What is it?" asked Meredith.
Jack looked at her grimly. "It's Ross." The former Mr. Invincible lay motionless, his skin the colour and texture of wax. Meredith, sitting by his bedside, held his hand and wept softly. On the other side of the bed stood Jack, Jodie, and Sergeant Andy Davison. Jack had his arm around Jodie's thin shoulders.
"Oh, Ross,"
Meredith whispered, breaking the silence. Softly, Jack said, "I'm truly sorry for your loss." Meredith looked up, her face red and teary.
"It wasn't your fault."
"No," Jodie said. "It was mine." She slipped away from Jack and around the foot of the bed to her mother's side, moving with a new grace and elegance. Crouching down, she said, "I'm so sorry, Mum." Meredith gripped her daughter's hand, trying and failing to smile through her tears.
"You've got nothing to apologize for, sweetheart. You were only doing what you thought was best." "But people died because of me,"
her voice faltered.
"Dad died because of me."
She looked up at Andy, her eyes a startling azure green.
"I deserve to be punished."
"It was thanks to you that your dad saved a lot of people who would have been hurt, or worse," said Jack. He looked down at Ross's motionless body and shook his head. "Besides, I think you've already been punished enough. What the universe gives with one hand, takes away with the other." He glanced at Andy, who took that as his cue to speak. Puffing at his cheeks, the policeman said,
"Jack's right, love. And to be honest, I wouldn't know where to start. I mean, what would I charge you with?"
Jodie touched the amber stone around her neck and began to weep quietly. Jack tapped Andy on the arm and glanced meaningfully at the door.
"I think it's time we left," he said. "Give these good people some privacy."
Andy nodded.
"Well, goodbye," he said to Meredith. "You know where to find me if you need, well, anything."
She gave a brief nod, and then he and Jack turned away. At the door, Jack paused and glanced back. "You guys look after each other," he said. Jodie looked up, her eyes shining with tears, but also with a new strength and determination.
"We will," she replied. "You can count on that."
Torchwood, Mr. Invincible by Mark Morris, was read by Tom Price.